Gas attack. Mart McKenna. Early in January, the battle flared up anew, and the British stubbornly crept ever closer and closer until shells rained constantly in the village. Two of the women were slightly wounded, and several times I had narrow escapes. One day, after an intensive bombardment, the town commandant sent for me and said, "Fraulein, I have given orders that all you women are to be evacuated to Roulers. In your case, both the medical officer and myself will strongly recommend you to the hospital authorities at Roulers." Under escort next day, and with our few miserable belongings, we took our last look on the beautiful village of our childhood dreams, for its disappearance was to be utter and complete. Two events of supreme importance were quickly to happen to me after my arrival in Roulers. Gratefully, the hospital authorities accepted my offer of help, and I began nursing in earnest. Then the mysterious reappearance of Lucelle Deldonc, and my promise to her to spy and work for the British intelligence. Of the instant success and luck of my initial attempts in this dangerous undertaking, I need not speak here. But these first successes spurred me on to greater efforts, and very soon I was to discover intrepid allies in this dangerous work. Of the normal routine of transmitting less important secret information, such as the arrival and departure of troops, identity and destination of German regiments, and the like, I shall make no mention, because it would become tedious, and the reader will no doubt take this detail work for granted. It is more the outstanding episodes that concern us here. In the middle of March 1915, my father, who had joyfully welcomed mother and me in Roulers, was offered the proprietorship of the Café Carillon by its owner, who, with his family, was going to a town farther behind the lines. The café nestled in the shadow of the tall grey church of Roulers, on the Grande Place, and this incidentally sheltered the café, to some extent, from Allied shellfire. Wide steps led up from the Grande Place to a beautiful façade of old Flemish style, and through this one passed into a large room with a counter, which was used as the café. The two upper stories at the back of the house had been demolished by a bomb, and were nothing but bricks, rubble, and splintered beams. But for all that, there was ample accommodation. My mother and I pondered for long over this offer. It certainly presented many advantages, being reasonably safe, with spacious cellars, and the income would greatly help the ménage, for the war had sadly curtailed father's assets. Men will talk, I reasoned, and boast over strong liquor, and I realized that much useful information might be garnered in such a café. But on the other hand, the thought persisted. Was it too obvious? In actual practice, should I be placing myself in too prominent and dangerous a position? At that time, there were many exaggerated stories current among the Germans in Belgium of the café girls and the way they had suffered for trying to make the troops talk. Although I feared these tales might throw suspicion upon me, I decided in the end that the advantages would prove worth the risk. As I would no longer have to come in contact merely with the hospital staff, with whom I was on the best of terms, but with all kinds of officers and men who would probably frequent the café, I made up my mind to adopt a definite attitude to the invader. Frequently I acted as spokesman and go-between for the townsfolk in their dealings with the town commandant. I was, therefore, to some extent, in the good books of the authorities, and without presuming on this, or overstepping the bounds, I must, above all else, keep this goodwill. A too friendly attitude on the surface would almost certainly arouse the suspicion of the German Secret Service, who were by no means fools. But at the same time, I must contrive to be popular in a detached way, and to gain the confidence of the men, so that I was the very last person in the world they would suspect. Then again, a too sympathetic attitude to the invader would call down the wrath of my own compatriots who rightfully looked on friendliness with the detested German as a treachery to Belgium. In a terribly difficult position, therefore, I bore myself as an aloof, rather detached girl, who was quite honestly and openly in sympathy with the Allied cause and the sorrows of downtrodden Belgium, but as one nevertheless who held no ill feeling against individual fighting men, so long as they behaved themselves. I made a point of bestowing my smiles on regular clients, and I readily arranged for washing, mending, and other small jobs to be done for them. Never encourage anyone, never speak to anybody. Just let them know you are there, and wait for them to make the overtures, became the essence of my policy. It was amazing how well this attitude worked, and within a very short time it began to show startling results. Only three persons in our immediate circle knew the intelligence nom de guerre, Laura, by which I was known. My mother, of course, knew I was Laura. Canteen Ma, the intrepid vegetable woman, and the mysterious number 63, who took my messages and dispatched them over the frontier, were the other two who were in the secret. So we moved into the new life during March, and from the first the café was not only well patronized by the military, but was also extensively used by civilians. One large room on the first floor, which overlooked the Grand Place, we reserved as a private room, to be used for dinner parties and special entertainments. When not in use for other purposes, it was used as a lounge for officers, and at nights this place usually quickly filled, when cigar smoke and restless chatter and argument made a lively scene. When it was my turn to be home for evenings from the hospital, I made it a practice to help wait on our clients, reinforcing the two maids we kept. A week after we had taken over the café, I returned from the hospital rather earlier than usual, and was met by Bertha, one of our serving maids. Her face was very concerned as she told me there were three officers just arrived who had announced their intention of billeting upon us. This was the last thing I wanted, being afraid that this proximity in the house might curtail my activities. But there was no help for it, as the town was packed with troops, and the three had the yellow slips of billeting requisitions. The lounge had not yet filled, and when the handbell rang, I went to ask for orders, anxious to see what sort of men were to live the daily round with us. Three officers sat round the oak table in the center of the room, gazing over empty wine glasses. They had flung their equipment in a pile on the floor. Two hauptmanns leaned back with tunics undone and puffed black cigars. The other, a fair leutnant, very neat and tightly buttoned up, watched me, elbows on table and chin on hands. When I had brought the wine they had ordered, the large, florid hauptmann with red hair raised his glass. "Fraulein, won't you do us the honor to drink a glass with us?" he commenced. Then, rising to his feet, "Drink to our trip to Paris." He looked across at the others in a very knowing way. "Thank you, Herr," I returned, "but I have had a very trying day at the hospital, and there are times when I feel that I do not require a drink." I was, however, decidedly intrigued with that queer look he had flashed at the others when he mentioned the trip to Paris. It was perhaps a merely fatuous remark, born of a fervent wish. But that acute, inexplicable sense of being on the track of a secret was beginning to develop in me, even in those early days.
"So, you are from the big hospital on the Meinen Road?" rumbled the red-haired man, as though I had committed some crime.
"Really, Red Carl," interposed a cherubic young voice. "You haven't been sent here to court-martial this Fraulein, you know."
I noticed the speaker's wavy golden hair and his lively eyes. He appeared a very attractive, boyish kind of officer. The other hauptmann, a long, cadaverous man of middle age, with hair so closely cropped that his head appeared shaved, examined me through large spectacles, whilst a cold smile played on his face.
"Perhaps the Fraulein will be kind enough to show us our quarters," he suggested in a strangely quiet voice. There was something intense and queer about this man, which made me feel he was a dangerous type of individual to cross. The trio followed me silently. I intended to give the spectacled Hauptmann a room to himself, as obviously he was the senior, and allot the only remaining room we had to be shared by the other two. But the spectacled one turned to me. "Fraulein," he said, "I shall share with the Herr Hauptmann. We have work which we must carry on together." And his eyes glinted behind his glasses.
"The Herr Leutnant can take my room."
"Splendid," chuckled the Leutnant. "Red Carl, if you snore as thunderously tonight as you did in the train last night, I think at the Hauptmann's hands you will die a nasty, sticky death."
"Oh, no, you wouldn't kill me, would you, you sinister old devil?"
Red Carl returned with a great guffaw.
"I'm too damned valuable to you, eh?"
I showed the two into their room, and then went back to the Leutnant, who had called.
"Queer couple, those two, aren't they, Fraulein?"
he opened.
"Possibly you think them a trifle rude and surly. Not the usual type of our army officer."
"Yes," I agreed. "But they appear to be ill-assorted, yet very friendly. What are they?" I had immediately noticed that neither of the Hauptmanns were of the Army of Württemberg, that they wore the badges of some special unit which I failed to recognize.
"Just two representatives whom we have sent ahead to arrange our trip to Paris."
He laughed cryptically. I knew it would be imprudent to press the matter further, but I was convinced there was some deep mystery here which needed probing. The Leutnant told me his name was Otto von Prompft. He lighted an expensive cigarette and offered me his case. Perhaps, I thought, as I stood there smoking, a little easy flattery might open his confidences. "You were a student, I see," I remarked.
"So you noticed my dueling scar, Fraulein?"
he responded with great pride.
"I left Stuttgart 6 months ago."
Then he suddenly broke into fluent French. He told me he had lived in Paris most of his life until the war.
"I have been in various parts of Belgium," he told me during the conversation. "Everywhere it is the custom of you Belgians to bewail the terrible conditions under which you are forced to live. But I have recently returned from leave, and I dare say you will be surprised to hear that in Berlin the regulations are just as severe as those you know in Belgium."
He went on to paint a distressing picture, and appeared absolutely frank and open in all he said. I remained wary, however, thinking perhaps his apparent frankness might be a ruse to draw me.
"But we Germans," he finished with a sigh, "know how to put up with a lot, so it does not greatly matter. We are bound to win."
"You may win great victories," I mildly observed, unable to let this confident prophecy pass. "But I do not believe you will emerge from this war the victors."
"Fraulein,"
he returned with perfect good humor,
"as yet Germany is not even tried. But a victory, sudden, overwhelming victory, is coming, and coming very soon."
Some officers came into the lounge and were ringing the bell impatiently, so I told the Leutnant I must go. Altogether, we had been speaking for more than half an hour. I was a little uncertain of the cherubic Otto, but those frank eyes of his somehow gave you the impression that he genuinely liked you. Would this be a well at which one could pump? I decided to make the better acquaintance of Leutnant Otto. In my hospital ward, there were two wounded British prisoners. They were put there because I spoke English. The time was rapidly approaching when they would be moved to a prisoners of war camp. I had racked my brains and made anxious, tentative inquiries with a view to getting the lovable pair over the frontier. I knew there were intrepid and brave men amongst my compatriots who were only too willing to act as guides. But I had frankly admitted to myself it were best in all the circumstances to hide as far as possible the nature of my undertakings, and not to become mixed up with daredevil runners, who undoubtedly carried on their hair-raising work at the risk of a firing squad. But I had become very good friends with the two prisoners,
and my heart bled when I thought of the sufferings in store for them when they were imprisoned in one of those degrading camps. Harrowing stories had already reached us, and I was determined that two Britishers at least would have their chance of freedom. One of the men was a tall Highlander who wore a kilt. The other was a diminutive, talkative soldier, and both belonged to Canadian units. Jimmy was a common little man, originally emanating from a London slum. He possessed all the ever-ready wit and good humor of his class, and was always cheerful. He made a joke when we put him on the operating table, and followed it with another one, before he was violently sick when he woke up after we had done with him. I eventually found I was able to understand the Highlander's Scotch patois. He had been a miner in civil life and was self-educated, with a serious but argumentative outlook on life. He had taught himself quite a fair knowledge of French, and I used to lend him books in that language. "It has always been me wish, Letty," he confided to me one night, "if I could but acquire the learning to become a minister." His meaning rather puzzled me at first, for ministers are associated in our minds with high politics. But when I did understand, I could not help smiling at the thought of this gaunt giant who decorated every tenth word with Jesus Christ, ministering to his flock in a black suit. His name was Arthur. One morning, I entered the ward to hear Jimmy and Arthur in fierce dispute, a not uncommon occurrence.
"Have ye no been to Shuleman? Do ye ken nothing?"
expostulated Arthur mournfully to his grinning mate, who had just remarked something about a bee liar. "Arthur!" At my intense whisper, he turned his head. As I slipped close to his bed, an eager look lighted his face. At intervals, we had talked together in the hospital grounds on their daily airing, and I had vaguely hinted at assisting them to escape. On the pretext of tucking in his sheets, I whispered rapidly, "Here are a few hundred francs for you and Jimmy. When you are out walking in the grounds this evening, look out for a small Belgian with a squint. He will be standing near the civilian workers' annex. Slip through the door. You will be found civilian clothes. And trust your guide. He will get you over the frontier." Then I was gone, leaving Arthur gasping. Both were in the convalescent stage, and their wounds might, with care, stand the 30-mile trip to the Dutch frontier. In any event, the attempt must be now, as any day the order for their removal might arrive. The money was all I could raise at the moment, but Pierre, the Belgian civilian, would also help if it were necessary. The rest of the day I was on tenterhooks. Had a clue been left by which, if the lads were caught, I could be traced? I knew they would never betray me, no matter what happened. But of Pierre, I was not so certain. Before the war, he had been known as one of the worst characters in Roulers, had been a drunkard, and had rarely worked. Prison had known him numberless times for petty theft. But he was a cheery old ruffian with a squint eye and a detestation for the invader, which no amount of punishment seemed to suppress. It was he who had broached the idea of the escape when I had spoken to him a fortnight before, while he was pruning rose bushes in the hospital garden. I was chary of using such a notorious character, but short of pushing inquiries through other channels, I had no other way for the terribly short time at my disposal. So Pierre, I had decided, must be the medium. Soon after giving these whispered instructions to the two Canadians, a wire came through that two ambulance convoys were to be expected, and in the rush of work, the matter slipped my mind. At 6 o'clock, I went off duty, ate a hasty meal, and then tried to read. The printed words ran meaninglessly in front of me, as I pictured the two poor wounded fugitives making the desperate attempt for freedom. It must have been 8 o'clock when there was a sudden ringing of the alarm bell from the hospital. I hurried over to my ward. Orderlies were rushing about and waving their arms, and when I glanced over to the corner, I saw Jimmy's bed was empty, as was Arthur's.
"What do you know of this, nurse?"
An irate Feldwebel roared at me. Two prisoner patients from your ward walk off right under your nose. When did you see them last? Have they got civilian clothes or money? I professed complete ignorance of the whole affair. I had been off duty and had seen nothing. In any case, I volunteered, I am certain they cannot get far, because their wounds are bound to burst with any extra exertion. This remark seemed to appease the Feldwebel and the listening orderlies, and presently I managed to slip into the civilian's annex, where some workmen lived and assisted in ambulance work. In the doorway I met a man I had never seen before, a big bearded fellow with flaxen hair, dressed in rough clothes, but who spoke with a cultured accent.
"Good evening, sister. A good friend of mine asked me to give you a message. His friends are leaving and will be in Holland by midnight."
That was all, and the man slunk away. I breathed freely again. The squint-eyed Pierre had done the trick. When I returned, I passed directly into the kitchen, and my mother informed me that two soldiers were in the sitting room and had asked twice to see me. She told me she knew the pair by sight. They were evidently soldiers billeted in the town. Such men I avoided as much as possible, because, as a rule, they knew less than the civilians, so there was no point in cultivating friendliness. It was, therefore, with no little trepidation, I walked into the sitting room to interview the insistent callers. "Alphonse! Stéphane!" I ejaculated in surprise, as I caught sight of the grim-looking soldiers. Alphonse was an Alsatian, driver of a Red Cross ambulance, and one who, by unfailing courtesies, had given me the impression of being not only friendly, but sympathetic towards my country. Stéphane, his friend, was a Pole, employed as a clerk in the brigade orderly room, who sported a thin, dark moustache and appeared rather a delicate young man. Both had been most friendly to me. They were eyeing me queerly now. Could they be German agents? Decoys? Flashed through my mind. I was a fool not to have connected them with counter-espionage work. They were just the type the Germans would employ, and no doubt they had got wind of this escape of the two British prisoners. The palms of my hands grew clammy at the thought. Was my masquerade finished?
"Alphonse has cut his finger, repairing the engine of his car. Nothing serious, sister. But as we were passing," explained Stéphane quietly.
"Of course," I said, my heart beating wildly. "Of course, I will dress it for him. Sit down, won't you, whilst I fetch my bandages?" I ran upstairs to my room in an agony of apprehension, at once destroyed several notes I had there, and a roll of Japanese writing paper. How long had they been in the house? Why had they called? The thin excuse of the cut finger was too stupid for words. If indeed the wound required dressing, Stéphane could have dressed it himself. Had they really discovered my dual role? All these questions, then, and 100 wild suppositions hammered at my brain as I picked up my little workbasket and bandages and descended to the room again. Stéphane was sitting on the table when I entered, and Alphonse was pretending to examine the pictures on the walls. I tried to persuade myself that everything was all right, that their visit, after all, was perfectly natural. Yet it was only with a great effort I managed to steady myself and appear quite unperturbed. "Now, Alphonse," I said, "where is this cut?" And then, as I was bending over a small gash in his finger, which he might easily have bandaged himself, he asked in a grave, still voice,
"How do you like your double job, sister?"
I felt myself go as pale as death, but kept my head down so that he could not observe my agitation, and, clenching my teeth, willed my hands not to tremble.
"Perhaps you would like a pin to fasten the bandage," he suggested as he saw me finishing. "A safety pin, perhaps."
My heart bounded with joy, and the relief was almost too great as slowly I gazed up at him.
"Have you a small one handy?" I inquired huskily.
He lifted the lapel of his great coat, showing two diagonal safety pins. With a great gasp of relief, I smiled and looked with swimming eyes at Stefan. He too disclosed the emblem by which we were to know friends and fellow workers for freedom in our sector.
"So you see, sister, we all serve together, eh?"
queried Alphonse, using this remark so as to give me time to cover up my emotion. "How did you get to know?" I demanded after a while.
"The sergeant major of the canteen told us to visit you, sister."
"What?" I gasped, horrified. "That German?"
"He is not German, sister," smiled Alphonse. "Not many years ago, that ranting sergeant major was a cadet at the military college of Sandhurst, England. He was sent to Germany before the war."
"And he sent you to me?" I asked, still mystified.
"Yes. He was worked very closely with Canteen Ma, and until yesterday was our channel of communication. But unfortunately, he has been transferred to Lille. Stefan here works at brigade headquarters, so you can understand he sometimes learns things that are most interesting. And as I myself frequently go up the line, and also manage to pick up a thing or two, we had a compact little system. But this transfer for the moment seemed to end matters as far as we were concerned. We were told, however, that our messages must be handed to Laura. And when we knew who Laura was, you could have knocked us down with less than a feather."
"You have information for me?" I asked quickly, vowing at the same time never to let a guilty conscience master me again.
"First of all, sister, let us speak of another matter that is certainly of immediate importance to you."
It was the pale Stefan who was speaking, as he nervously fingered one end of his mustache.
"There is billeted in this café a young officer named Otto von Prompt."
"That is so," I replied.
"You like him?"
was the surprising question. "What has that to do with it?" I demanded. "He appears an agreeable boy, and better than most Germans."
"Ah, that is the line they take," drawled Stefan, shaking his head grimly. "The charming Otto has been sent to this area as a decoy."
"Then, as he has been placed here, I am suspected?" I asked breathlessly. "How do you know this?" I gasped.
"They do not necessarily suspect you, sister. The Germans suspect all Belgians, unless they are imbeciles or on their deathbeds. But there is a chance that you are to be kept under surveillance, and it might be very necessary for you to be watchful in return. I will tell you how I discovered about this bright Otto. It is one of my duties at Brigade HQ to assist the censor office. I open the letters of the troops, place them before him, and close them for posting when he has finished censoring. Sometimes the censor arrives late. He always takes a long time over his meals. It is not, therefore, difficult for me to find opportunities to examine many letters, and often before the censor has attacked them with his blue pencil. The mail of officers usually arrives at HQ in separate packages, and these I naturally consider most likely to yield matter of value. It was last week in one of these packages I came upon the letter of a certain Leutnant Otto von Prompt. He was telling his mother that the special work which he had been detailed for in Roulers was both agreeable and interesting, and allowed him much freedom and leisure, and that if he were successful in his mission, which he had every hope in the end he would be, he would no doubt be installed in a cushy job in Berlin. This letter was both interesting and unusual, and after careful inquiries I found the charming Otto was billeted at this café, was friendly to everyone, and was employed neither regimentally nor by the police, nor indeed in any normal branch of the staff. He is employed by the Army Group Secret Service on a special mission.
I am more than grateful to you, I assured Stefan, mentally stabbing the deceitful Otto. I was not so much frightened at the moment as furiously indignant with him for signaling me out for notice, and for the fact that I had placed him on the same plane as Corporal Dresser Evendan, as a German one could abide. Now, have you information for me to pass on?
I asked.
Perhaps we could have a little wine over which to discuss it, sister, for it is a puzzler, I can assure you, said Alphonse, tickling the back of his close-cropped head.
I went to fetch the wine, and at the foot of the stairs I came face to face with the deceitful Otto.
I hope you will find time to join me later, Fraulein.
Not this evening, Herr Leutnant, I excused myself. I am tired. Perhaps tomorrow. It is strange that when you know the true character of a person, the face often seems to change from that which you have previously known. This happened with Leutnant Otto. The boyish lineaments appeared to have given place to a cunning, foxy expression. It was imperative, however, to keep up my friendly footing, hoping that he did not and would not suspect. When I returned to my two new conspirators, Stefan began to talk rapidly. In the last ammunition train to arrive, he explained, besides the usual freight, were several trucks containing long metal cylinders. He had not been able by any means to discover for what they were intended, and he was doubtful even if the German brigade headquarters knew themselves.
Whatever they are intended for, he said, I think perhaps a bomb would do them a bit of good. So the sooner you inform our relations over the border, the better. The British might think them intriguing enough to send over a couple of bombing planes.
I shall send the information over tonight, I promised. Meanwhile, do your utmost to find out from Brigade what these cylinders contain.
I, too, have some unusual information for you, sister,
interposed Alphonse.
Yesterday afternoon, when normally I should have been off duty, I and another ambulance driver were sent on several trips to and from the station, bringing bales of cotton wool swabs to the hospital store. They were not dressing pads for wounds, as they have pieces of elastic and a catch attached to them. I have never seen anything like them before.
Was there no sort of descriptive label on the bales? I asked.
There was no label describing what they were for, but this is the strangest part of all. The consignment was not addressed to the medical officer of the hospital, or even to any officer of the medical corps. The label simply stated that the consignment was to be held at the disposal of a certain Hauptmann Reichmann.
Hauptmann Reichmann? I ejaculated with astonishment. He is billeted here.
Yes, we know that, sister. Stefan discovered it from the brigade register. But he appears to belong to no unit, and nothing there is known about him. But he has visited Brigade 3 times, and each time has long private conferences with the Brigadier himself, interrupted Stefan. Sister, I think you should take every opportunity of watching this officer, for obviously there is something of importance developing, suggested Alphonse.
Presently the two of them bade me good night. We had agreed that in future dealings only two of us must ever be seen together at the same time, and that we must not seem to be anything but casual acquaintances to outsiders. It was late, and most of our clients had left, some a trifle noisily, for their sleeping quarters. As there might be nothing in the matter, there was no point in informing the British about our cadaverous guest, Reichmann. But to myself, I determined to keep my eyes wide open. In my room, then, that night, I described the arrival of the cylinders and the mysterious swabs. When written, the warning looked enigmatic, even comical. But it was not my business to ponder the solution. That was the job of the jigsaw readers in London. The key to the riddle might fall into their hands from an altogether different source. I put the message in my hair and slipped down the darkened stairs, then into the silent streets. My hospital night pass allowed me perfect freedom, but I shrank away into the shadows as the gruff voices of a patrol and the clink of metal reached me from the other side of the square. It was very dark, but presently I arrived at the silent alleyway which harbored the mysterious number 63. At the 5th window on the left-hand side, I tapped according to the signal. Once, a pause, then a rapid double knock.
The frame slid up without a sound. The mysterious hand appeared, and into it I pushed my precious notes. Then, as though the evil one himself was after me, I sped away from the alley. A few mornings later, I saw Canteen Ma in the Grand Place. She was, as usual, surrounded by laughing soldiers, giving a joke and talking some good-humored chaff as she sold the fruit and vegetables from her cart. She had been named Canteen Ma since the day the Rouleur's canteen sergeant major had taken the whole of his supplies from her. In her, he had discovered a shrewd, clever spy of indomitable courage, and one who, in the capacity of vegetable hawker, covered a wide and vital area. Besides the incredibly important items of news she managed to pick up, she had organized a gang of desperate runners who, fearing nothing, kept up an uninterrupted line of communication with the Dutch frontier. It was through this heroic woman I received my instructions from British intelligence. As her shrewd eyes met mine, they glittered, and she made a sign to me indicating she wanted to speak. I contrived to move close to her, and she whispered, "Martha, there is something in the air. Too much talk of sweeping victory amongst the men for things to be normal. Yet nobody seems to know anything." She brushed a few grinning soldiers away from her cart, then turned to me again and asked, "Have you heard anything?" "No," I returned, "but I have heard the same talk amongst the officers billeted with us." "We must keep our eyes and ears open, Martha," she enjoined anxiously as she moved away. That same evening, Stefan supplied another piece of the puzzle. He said that Reichmann had started sending in weather reports to Brigade twice a day. The variations of the wind were graphed. The district comprised the Rouleurs Menon and Polkapelle Paschandel roads. Red Carl had several times been up in an aeroplane taking observations, and twice in an observation balloon on the Menon Road. I came to the conclusion that Hauptmann Reichmann might have some papers in his room, which would perhaps supply a clue. Accordingly, I asked my mother to help make beds with the maids and to keep her eyes open. She quickly told me that Reichmann filed duplicate copies of strange graphs on his table, and that he was also keeping a sort of log of the weather and wind movements. I determined then to search the room myself. Next morning I sent to the hospital saying I was unwell, and when I saw Red Carl, Hauptmann Reichmann, and Leutnant Otto depart, I crept from my room into Reichmann's and examined the documents on his table. Sure enough, there was the weather log, along with its movements and the wind graphs. But there was nothing else. I also tried the papers of Red Carl, but there again I found nothing of any interest, only strange calculations and figures of which I could not make head nor tail. I left the room as mystified as I went in. But again, that night, I informed the British by the hand of 63, insisting that something mysterious was afoot. A few days later, Canteen Ma called, and in the small pincushion she left, which contained my messages, I found this, screed in code: "Do not worry about weather reports, troop movements, designation of units, and destination of trains, etc., etc., of more value." But for all that, I did continue to worry, and that night I found myself going to bed even more puzzled. Red Carl was sitting in a corner of the smoky lounge by himself. He looked slightly worse for drink and appeared to want someone to talk to. He beckoned to me, so I crossed and stood a while by his side.
"Have you ever been to Germany, Fraulein?"
he asked, offering me a cigarette and lighting it with a rather shaky hand. "No, Herr," I replied, perhaps a little too shortly.
"You do not like the Germans, Hein?"
"Well, you could not expect us exactly to love them after what we have suffered, and after the shambles they have made of our country, could you, Herr Hauptmann?"
"Ach, never mind, Fraulein. You will like us better when you understand us. And even if we don't win the war soon, we shall have pressed so far into France that Rulers will hardly know a German soldier, except for a patrol now and then.
Nach Paris, nach Calais.
He banged his empty glass so hard I was surprised it did not break in his hand. Then ensued a little pause, while he sat dreaming heroically in a mirage of alcoholic glory. You Germans are good at that story, I taunted quietly. I could tell you the names of several officers who used the same war cry last year. Nach Paris, nach Calais is as great a dream as ever.
Ach, you may think so, Fraulein. You may all think we are slow, but I know.
And in his deep way he chuckled.
And yet it's all funny, mein Fraulein, damned funny. Here I am, Karl Sturmo, a despised chemist, and a man whom these snobs of generals with their choker collars, their eyeglasses and brass hats, would in the old days have regarded with as much respect as they did the cobblestones under their feet, but who is now going to play a bigger hand in winning the mightiest war the world has ever seen than they themselves, for all their swaggering militarism.
He continued chuckling to himself, drunkenly, until some friends came up to him when I left him. But all the evening he kept them laughing with a continual flow of tipsy bragging, and through my mind the news for some unaccountable reason kept drumming. Karl, the chemist, Red Karl, a chemist, a disgruntled officer, with no sort of recognition, a braggart who boasted in his cups of sweeping victory by some mysterious means. He was so cocksure, I told myself. There must be a grain of sense among all the chaff. But where? Where was it? I went to bed racking my brains, seeking an answer to the riddle. The following day, I managed to find an opportunity to tell both Stéphane and Alphonse what Karl had said the night before. Alphonse thought that Karl had invented some new type of artillery, and that the calculations and wind graphs might have something to do with accurate firing. Stéphane suggested that if there was to be a great advance in that area, as was apparently the case, the authorities might be considering Rulers as a Zeppelin base, as there was no doubt the town and the environs were ideally situated for such a base. I did not feel satisfied with either of these suppositions, but decided to mention both in my next message. Alphonse had another piece of news for me. He said he had been told by a man in charge of the dump of metal cylinders that they contained chlorine, but still he did not know what use was to be made of them. I was not, as a matter of fact, inclined to pay much attention to the cylinders. On the way home, however, the analogy between chemist and chlorine suddenly struck me. Could Red Karl have anything to do with those cylinders? Red Karl had said strange things, and it was my duty to report everything that came under my notice. Perhaps it all seemed a little far-fetched, trying to associate Red Karl and Hauptmann Reichmann with swabs, wind graphs, and chlorine. But I risked a snub from intelligence. I sent over everything, giving my reasons and suggestions. It was my job to report. It was the job of British intelligence to unravel the puzzle from the clues sent to them. And I contented myself with this thought. 3 days later, back came the message. Recent reports from you of a highly speculative nature. Repeat, troop movements, designation of units, trains and dumps, etc., etc., of more value. So they evidently thought me an imaginative girl who conjured molehills into mountains. I was not discouraged. The weather watchers continued to submit their reports day after day, and I made one new discovery. I talked to the gaunt Reichmann one evening and drew him on to speak of his life in pre-war days and of his home. He had been a professor of a big university. It was not difficult to guess what he had been a professor of,
when one remembered his association with Carl, and, a fact which I subsequently noticed, that he received regularly periodicals of a scientific character by home mail. The mysterious rumor of victory before summer seemed to have become an obsession among the Germans. The inspired press helped matters on, and grotesque, ribald, and indecent cartoons depicting Allied soldiers in all kinds of degrading situations flooded every journal. One morning in April, I reached the hospital to find it full of bustle. All possible cases that could be moved were to be evacuated at once. A civilian medical station was to be opened in the town itself, so as to relieve the hospital of this branch of work, which was sometimes considerable.
"Ah, Fraulein,"
greeted the Oberarzt in his genial voice.
"I think we are in for a big advance. All stations this side of Ghent have been warned to evacuate all wounded immediately."
Repressing my burning interest, I remained silent, expecting to hear some further information, and perhaps the key to the mystery. But to my disappointment, he passed on without another word. This was important news in any case. Evacuation of hospitals close to the front meant attack. Empty hospitals to receive the broken wretches who would return. That night, I got my urgent report away by number 63. Then anxiously I waited and watched for the flood of reinforcements. But day followed day, and no further troops arrived. The 26th and 27th Corps of the Württemberg Army held the sector, front and reserve lines. The army carried out its reliefs as usual. Not an extra gun or an extra soldier passed up the line. We were all completely mystified. In talking the conundrum over with Alphonse, he thought perhaps it might mean a feint at this part of the salient to cover some determined attack at another point. I had grave misgivings, and I could only comfort myself with the thought that we had done everything possible. I had faithfully recorded every clue that had come under my notice. Then, a short week later, the solution fell with a blinding crash. The 22nd of April, 1915, I well remember, was a beautiful day with gentle spring breezes bringing promise of early summer. But from the slopes of the Passchendaele ridges, another kind of breeze, a devil's wind, had been slowly creeping over no man's land, enveloping the Allied trenches about Polkapelle and Langemark in a mysterious haze of death. Soon after dawn on the 23rd, I received an urgent message from the hospital to be in attendance immediately. I hurried there, and almost at once the stream of ambulances with the unfortunate prisoners began to arrive. At first scores, then later hundreds of broken men, gasping, screaming, choking. The hospital became packed with French and British soldiers, beating and fighting the air for breath. Dozens of men died like flies under our eyes, their clothes and uniforms rent to ribbons in their agony, their faces a horrible sickly green, contorted out of all human shape. Tunics and brass buttons turned a grayish green, and a pungent, suffocating smell hung around them. When no more room could be found along the hospital corridors, the stretcher-bearers laid the unfortunate, gasping pieces of humanity out on the footpaths, on the open streets surrounding the building. "What is it? What is it?" kept pounding in my brain. "What devil's work is this?" As I worked amid that hellish scene, striving to soothe and quiet the stricken, and still the ambulances came packed with tortured prisoners, more and more forms struggled and tossed in the roadway. My heart bleeding with pity, I bent over a young British soldier, a Canadian, and whispered, "What has happened, brother?" He looked up with inflamed, swollen eyes, almost bursting from their sockets. But he could not speak, only painfully shake his head as he tried to prop himself up in my arms. And then, coughing and spitting and choking, he fell back dead. As the number of prisoners grew, the civilian population had gathered at both ends of the street. A section of German soldiers was trying to keep them back with the butts of their rifles, when suddenly a voice from the crowd cried, "Vive la France! Vive l'Angleterre!" That is a moment that will live forever in my memory, for the cry burst from every throat until it swelled to a mad, indignant roar. Even the poor, gassed prisoners tried to sit up and join in the cry, "Vive la France! Vive l'Angleterre!" as a last defiant battle cry to their implacable foes. Blinded with tears, the civilians pressed ever forward and showered useless cigarettes, bread, and chocolate on the stricken soldiers. God only knows where it came from, for all were fearfully short and hungry in those days. The savage crowd was getting out of hand, and several soldiers had been roughly treated, when suddenly there came the clatter of hooves, and a posse of mounted gendarmes trotted rapidly up the road. They put their horses into the crowd and started to force them away. The riddle of the Windgrafs had been answered. It is for the historian to tell how the Allied line was shattered and bent, how near the Germans were to a crushing victory, but how the comrades of those stricken wretches, who would still cry out, "Vive la France! Vive l'Angleterre!" withstood the shock and desperately won their way back through a hell of carnage. Nor will the historian forget those heroic victims who died under the first gas attack.